Now, welcome, Jamie.
Thank you. Keep track of my time here. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Let me tilt it.
There we go.
Pretty tall, so. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. Always an honor to be able to kind of share your experience with other people and see, you know, you throw it against the wall and you see what sticks. My sobriety date is March 4th, 2002. I've had one sponsor the whole time, Vivian P., and she has been my savior, so sponsorship's a great thing. I guess I'll do a traditional format, and I'll tell you what it was like, I'll tell you what happened to me, and then I'll tell you how I am today, and kind of the things I do today to stay sober. What it was like, I grew up the youngest of four, in a middle America kind of family. We were pretty close. Dad traveled all the time, but Mom was to stay at home. I was actually not really supposed to be born. I was a vasectomy baby. So, surprise! And as the tale of things to come, my parents had to declare bankruptcy the year I was born. So, like later on down the road, I probably should have seen those signs because that was the only time I was going to cost them an arm and a leg. But anyway, we were a pretty happy family. You know, there was the usual sibling rivalry. There was the usual spats with parents and stuff when you're a teenager. But for the most part, we loved each other in spite of our flaws. I'll fast forward to probably middle school because that's when things started to feel uncomfortable. I've always been a very independent person, and I never really needed a whole lot of like social interaction. And so it really didn't start shining through until I was in middle school, and all these like cliques developed of like different people, and I didn't have a place in any of those groups, and I couldn't figure out why. And I was like, well, whatever. We weren't rich, so I didn't have the nicest clothes or whatever. So I guess I just figured it was because of that. And then kind of moved into high school, and then they really got divided. And I was like, man, I don't really have a place anywhere. You know, I didn't really feel like I fit in. I felt like I was like an outsider, not tag along with this group, not tag along with that group, and, you know, and just not know where I fit in. And I grew up in my parents' church, and so I had a lot of those morals and instincts to do the right thing and to not get in trouble and to don't lie and don't have sex and don't do this and don't do that. And, you know, it was very, it was a little fire and brimstone-ish. So it was, you know, if you do this, you're going to hell. And I didn't really want to go there because that sounded pretty crappy. So I took their lead, and I did not do the things that I was not supposed to do. So I was a goody-two-shoes in my parents' eyes, but I was very lost on my own. Like, I just didn't know where I belonged or who I fit in with. And started dating a guy who was like, you know, Mr. Cool, and so all of a sudden I was kind of popular because I was dating this guy, and I really enjoyed that. I really was like, oh, okay, so I can get attention this way. This is pretty cool. This worked out. And we dated for many, many years, but after I got out of high school, I kind of just barely survived high school, but after I got out of high school, I started my first year of college, dean's list student, again, didn't drink, didn't use drugs. My first experience with alcohol was junior prom, where we had a bunch of chocolate liqueur that I had snuck into like my boyfriend's father's office, drank all this, and I threw it up all over their carpet, and nobody liked it when Jamie drank. So after that, it was a social kind of thing that I was like, I don't want to hurt people's feelings anymore, and I don't want to, you know, be looked down upon or whatever, so I didn't drink for a while. It was good stuff, don't get me wrong, but it was embarrassing, because part of my addiction is wanting to fit in and the social aspect of it. So anyway, I continued to date this guy and continued to just feel worse about myself and about my life and developed some outside issues, eating disorders, stuff like that, depression, and didn't really know why I was just so miserable, but just knew that I was absolutely in the wrong place, in the wrong body, in the wrong time. You know, I just didn't think I'd belong in this decade or something, like I was born too soon or too late. And I couldn't put my finger on it, you know, so I just kind of floated. And then I had like an epiphany one day. I was out with some friends, and they were going to the bar, Dark Horse Tavern And I was like, oh, I can't do that. And they're like, why not? Like, oh, I just can't. Why not? Well, I had no reason not to, so I did. And I got wasted. And that was it. Done. Went home that night, broke up with the guy. The next day, moved in with my girlfriend that we had drunk with the night before. And I was gone, you know. And it was just, it was instant, you know. I mean, it was not a, it might have been a buildup of about 2 weeks. But it immediately started drinking every day, you know. Being a really good college student, just went out the window really, really quickly and lost my scholarship. Got academically dismissed from Georgia State or whatever. And I was like, well, screw that. I don't really need any of that action. I found my calling, you know, and I felt like I finally, like, belonged in my skin. You know, I felt like I finally was like, okay, this is who I am. All of a sudden, I'm pretty, I'm funny, I'm cool, people like me, you know, and it was just like this great feeling of like arrival or something. And so I for a couple of months, just floated along and bartended and made money and spent it all that night on booze and drugs and stuff like that. And, you know, wasn't really fully satisfied, but it was way better than it was before. You know, it was still way better than just that isolation and misery and discontent that I couldn't put my finger on, you know. And so at least I knew that when I drank, I felt good. And so when I wasn't drinking, like when I woke up or whatever, I was like, ooh, we need to get the show on the road because it's starting to come back. And, you know, I started to develop like really like crazy like behaviors and what I couldn't explain, like cutting and stuff like that. And I didn't know why, so I was sitting, I'm happy, you know. I'm like, I'm so incredibly happy with my drinking. I don't understand why I have to do these kinds of things. But, you know, I didn't put a whole lot of thought into it, so it wasn't that big of a deal. And so things kind of progressed like that for just like another year. And I just floated along, gave up on the family because they didn't like my lifestyle. F off, you know, I can do this on my own, thanks very much. Big fat bartender at Fuzzy's place, just some dive that, you know, I felt like I belonged in. And, you know, and it was great, and I just kind of existed. My boss would let me go home, roll a joint, bring it back, smoke it at work, as long as I was at work, you know. So I didn't get home and get stoned and not come back. So it was a good setup, you know. And for a while, it worked. I mean, really, like, for like a year. I mean, this is a short while. For like a year, it worked. And then it started getting just more, as we all have experienced, like, it wasn't enough, you know, like that didn't quite do it, so I needed a little bit more. I needed to try a different drug or, I'll try to stick to alcohol. I know this is singleness of purpose, but there's a lot of that other activity in my life and in my story, so, you know, my life today, but in my story. So, like, things just kept ramping up like that or whatever, and I guess it was probably, I had just turned 22 at this point, and got off my shift one night at Fuzzy's, and had a couple of, I've been drinking all night long, because they let you drink on the, behind the bar, and it was great, and so I was pretty hammered anyway when I left there, and then I drove to another pub, and had a couple of drinks there, and basically didn't even finish, because I was already hitting the floor, and I've always been a very control freak kind of person. I don't know if anybody can relate to that at all, but I was definitely a control freak, and especially about my car. Like, I didn't want anybody to mess with my car. It was a Jeep, and I loved it, and I was fine to drive. I would drive my drunk friends home when I was wasted, because I was obviously way better at it than they were, and I wasn't going to put my life in their hands. So all my expert, you know, practice sessions that I'd had driving home drunk and finding it in the mailbox or in the bush or the door wide open with keys still in it, car still running the next morning, and, you know, and all those events. So anyway, that night I drove home, and I didn't make it home, unfortunately. That was October 28th of 2001, and I hit an oncoming taxi cab, and I killed the driver. And it didn't sink in for a really long time. It wasn't until a few months down the road that I was in court that it had, like, hit me, you know. And at first, when I woke up, I saw on the ground, and they were like, yeah, he's dead. And I was just like, oh, fuck. Excuse my language, but I was just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And I couldn't see. I had gone through the windshield and wasn't wearing a seatbelt or any of that kind of mess. And, you know, and it was just like, holy crap. And immediately I'm like, okay, Mom, Dad, bail me out. I hadn't talked to y'all in a while, but I'm your little girl, you gotta bail me out, right? And there's certain things you just can't run from in life, and that turned out to be mine. And I got out of the hospital about a week later. I had minor injuries. The driver died on the scene about 4 hours later. The passenger directly behind the driver spent the next 10 hours in intensive surgery, and then the next 10 months in the hospital just with her injuries. She had hit the back plate on the cab and, like, crushed her face in, and just she had to have it all reconstructed, and she doesn't look the same today. And it's very unfortunate that we had to meet that night. And, you know, it's taken me a long time to come to grips with this, but I believe today that my addiction is what killed them, not me. If I had been sober that night, I wouldn't have driven into that car. But I didn't know how to be sober, and I didn't know how to want to be sober. You know, I didn't care anything about coming to meetings on 8 o'clock on a Monday night. You know, I had things to do, and so it was a rough couple of months after the accident, and after I got out of the hospital. I had a bond hearing. They let me go out on a signature bond with my family. I had to move back in with them and then deal with all of them, which did not want to do that because we hadn't been talking for a while anyway. And so they required that I come and get my paper signed and all that kind of stuff, and I did. And the only meeting I would come to was this one. I would only come to the 8 o'clock meetings at NABA. And I lived in, like, Peachtree Corners, but I had to go back with my folks in Peachtree Corners, so it wasn't like it was convenient. It was just the only place that I, like, trusted. I don't know why. I just felt at home here. I always have. I've always did. And so I'd come here, and I would just sit, and I'd cry in my little chair, and, you know, and sometimes I would talk, but I wasn't even talking. It was just, like, blubbering, you know? And people were so sweet, and I didn't really believe anybody here. One of the initial times I was here, this girl, Sarah, she was 21, 22, and she had, like, 5 years sober. Like, bullshit. Like, there's no way that you got sober when you were 18 years old, excuse me, miss, you know? I'm like, that's obviously a lie, so these people are full of it. And come to find out, she was being honest, you know? It's amazing that there's a degree of honesty in these rooms that you don't find in the real world. And I found it here, and I was able to kind of confront some of my stuff here. And I had a lot of support from a lot of women who put up with me those first couple of months. Because in the first 6 months, I was in and out. I mean, I didn't even pick up a white chip because I knew I wasn't going to keep it, you know. So I just, I probably could have picked up, you know, 30 or 40 of them, but I didn't want to. It was embarrassing. But thankfully, I'm an alcoholic. And so I tend to be motivated by a lot of pain. And so about 3 or 4 months after the car accident, still drinking and using drugs moderately, because now I'm getting drug tested, so I had to be a lot more cautious about that. And had me on Anabuse to try and help the alcoholism, which was just a joke, because then I found ways around it and thought I was slick and outwitting the system and really just shooting myself in the foot. But anyway, I went out one night and got hammered and had gotten into a fight and had some battery charges placed against me, which was not good either. And so, again, didn't shine too brightly in the court light. But what it did do for me, which I bring it up for this reason, was it made me realize how powerless I am over this thing. That I was trying to be good. I was trying really hard to be good and to not do stupid things and to just keep it in check, keep it under control, so I can handle this. You know, I'm a control freak. I can handle this. I can, like, compartmentalize everything, make a list, and do check, check, check. Okay, I'm good. You know, now I can have this, and I'll only have two, and I'll only do this. And, you know, that had never actually worked out. But finally, that last time that I got in trouble was great because it crushed me. You know, when I finally realized what happened, and then the authorities realized what happened, it crushed me. And the great thing about being on the bottom is the only way you go is up. And so at that point, I came to meetings and I listened. You know, somebody suggested a sponsor, I took it. And she's my sponsor today, and God, I don't know what I would be without her. You know, it's just the greatest gift when you find somebody that you relate to and you can be honest with, and you can see changes in your own life as a result of it. So at that point, I started on March 4th was my last drink. And then I started working with Vivian probably March 6th and have ever since then. I spent the next 90 days or so going to meetings every day, getting to know people, getting phone numbers. It wasn't easy. It's uncomfortable. And I had a lot of stuff in my mind, and I still have this pending, sentence to serve and all this kind of stuff. And I was pretty nerve-wracked. I mean, I was scared. But I met some other girls in here who had been in the big house, and they had survived it, and they were telling me their stories and helping me get through it. And so, in July, I went ahead and turned myself in to start serving time because I knew that it was coming. I knew that it was going to happen. And so, in May I did. I didn't go to court until July, so I sat in DeKalb County Jail for a couple months, and God, that place is horrible, so just don't get arrested in DeKalb County. excuse me. But you know what? Again, this was like my higher power working through me, because only it knew what it was going to take for me to open my eyes up. You know, it's really hard to look at yourself. For me, I had been drinking 18 months. I started drinking when I was 20-ish, halfway through my 20th year, and then got my accident right after my 22nd birthday. And then, I couldn't imagine that I was an addict. You know, in that short of a period of time, I just didn't think that it was possible. But I had come in here enough, and I had listened to the stories enough and laughed enough times to be like, yep, did that one. You know, oh, yeah, I did that one too. And, oh, crap, now I fit in, you know. And I didn't want to. I didn't want to admit that I had a problem. That was the hardest part of this whole thing for me, because then I knew I had to do something about it, and I didn't want to go there yet. Thankfully, that last drink got me here, and I'm just so grateful for it. It really saved my life. So in July, like I said, in May I went to DeKalb County Jail, spent 3 months there. Misery, heartache, depression, awful, awful, awful. But I had a bunkie that was in the program too, and we could talk, we could, kind of relate to each other, we could cry together, we could, we could be honest with each other. Hell, we're both in, the slammer at this point, who cares? What are you trying to look good for, And she had a pending case, I had a pending case, and so it was, it was good. And it was just a way that my higher power kind of was able to help me, put people in my life. As long as I was willing to open my hand up and talk to them, open my mouth up, open my ears up and listen to them, it kept working out, and I just had to be willing was the big thing for me. And it took a while. It took several months of trying and failing before I finally became willing. And so, was sentenced, went to court, and the first time I went to court, it was like, state of Georgia against Janie Webb. If you're not in here, please, if you're not in here for that case, please leave. And I'm looking around at all these people, waiting for me to get up and go. So I'm like, why aren't these people leaving? This row is where my family's sitting, so what are all these other people doing here? There's four victims in my car accident, and their families were there, and their relatives were there, and their grandbabies were there. And God, man, it was just to look into their eyes and to know what I had done. It was horrible, it was horrible. And it was so, it should have happened to me a million times, because I was the one that was really good at driving home, so let me go ahead and take you home. And it's ego, and to see all that was just another dose of humble pie that I needed. It was just another, every ounce of pain that I've had in my life so far has been for to get me to where I am today, which is a sober place. And much as I don't like it, it gets me here. I've sentenced to 10 years, served 3 in prison. So I did. I served 3 in prison. It wasn't easy. It's very lonely in there. It's very, you feel helpless. And you feel hopeless. You feel like, it's the end and all this kind of crap. But I will say this. It's only that way if you want it to be. There was plenty of days I had in there that I still didn't want to be there. But they had AA meetings, they had NA meetings, they had people from the outside who would come in, and that was a huge, huge gift. So if you ever get the opportunity to go into an institution and bring a meeting, I can't tell you how helpful that was for me. just to know that somebody on the outside, you know, I mean, like there's this whole different world between people on the inside and the outside world. And, you know, it becomes like a figment of your imagination, like, I don't know how to describe it, but you don't think that you'll ever be on that outside world again. And so you just talk about it like it's a dream or something. And people from the outside would come in and bring a meeting. And it was so incredibly heartwarming to know that you were cared about, you know, in spite of all the crap that we had all done to get there. I mean, you know, we were the worst of society, I guess you could say. And so it, you know, it was very heartwarming to see that people in the program cared that much. So I'd go to meetings twice a week. I wrote my sponsor. I did my first three steps while I was out, and then those first 90 days, and then worked on my first step for the next 3 years. And it was a long 3 years because I would write it out, do one column, and I'd mail it to her, and she'd revise it and then mail it back, and then the guards read it because they have to read all the mail, and it's just like, oh, man, it's embarrassing, especially when they're on the list, you know, and you're like... And I had two that were on the list that I just could... I had major resentments towards, and I know they read the mail sometimes, and I was like, sorry, you're going to be a meme. That's how I thought of it anyway. But, you know, it was... Everything's got a purpose. So anyway, after a very, very long... prolonged fourth step, I was able to get to the halfway house, and I spent my last 10 months in the halfway house, and I was able to see her for a visit, and we were able to sit down and do a fifth step, and it was great. It was long overdue and very gratifying to be able to, I felt like I'd already done it a million times because so many people already read it, but it still was nice to see my sponsor in front of me and talking me through it and pointing out my patterns of behavior and what my part in all this stuff was and what I kept doing that kept causing me so much pain, you know. It's not like, I've never really been under the delusion that I was perfect, but I figured I was pretty damn close, you know. And I'm like, obviously people have problems, I'm sure I've got some, I just don't see them, and most of the people don't see them because I'm a really good person. Right. So when we did that fifth step, she pointed out this whole long list of stuff that's all wrong with Jamie, and it was just like, damn, you know, I really didn't think I had that many problems, so it was very gratifying to finally do a fifth step with her. And we've continued, like I said, to work together ever since then. So I got out, and I got a job, and since then, it's been one day at a time. You know, it's there's been a lot of setbacks, I've been called a lot of names because of what I've done, and it's hard to not be hurt by it, but that's okay because, you know, in some cases I earned it. So, you know, you gotta put your big girl panties on and take it like a woman, and you know, kind of accept that there's not everyone's gonna like you, and not everybody's gonna give you an opportunity or whatever, just because, you know, I've convicted felon and all this kind of stuff, and I'm a violent criminal apparently, because it was a violent crime, so that was one that I never really liked, but anyway, I came right back to NABA. The day I got out, I came to NABA, and I sat in that other room, and cried, and hugged my sponsor, and was introduced to four other women that I didn't know, and I've become very good friends with them since, and I am no shining star of how to do this program, not a very good example. To be honest, it's just God that has gotten me to this point, because if there's a pothole, I'll fall in it. You know, I don't understand why. It's like my brain tells me what I need to know, and it's like, if you do these things, Jamie, your life will be a hell of a lot easier. Okay, well, let me go ahead and do this then, and just see how that works out for me. And it never does. And so, you know, I don't want to give you this illusion that my life's been perfect ever since I've got out. It's been difficult, but you know what? My friend used to say two things to me. My friend and slammer, Candy Bondi, and she was a wonderful woman that I don't know if she's alive today, but she would say two things. She would say, you know, God didn't drag you out from the beach so he could kick your ass in the sand. I was like, yeah, okay, so he saved me from drowning. He's not going to kill me now. And then she would also say that, you know, God will give you 100%, or God's not going to give you anything more than you can handle. But it doesn't mean he's not going to give you 100% of what you can handle. And that really struck a chord with me because it felt like a lot to me. I mean, in hindsight, I've never been homeless, never been raped, never had, you know, all of the horrible yets that I know a lot of these people in this room have experienced. And you've not had some of mine. And I think that's what makes us so great together, is because I can come here and put all my crap out, you can come and put all your crap out, and we can just laugh at it because it's just a bunch of crap laying there, and, you know, we've survived it, you know, and in a lot of ways I feel like a survivor because of it. And again, I don't want to take credit for any of this, because I feel like the only reason that I'm here today is because I allowed God, my higher power, to help me. It wasn't easy. I didn't always give up control, because I enjoy control. And, you know, it's a power struggle some days. I don't get on my knees every single day. I wish I did. I'd be lying to you if I said I did. But I get down on them, usually in two scenarios, when it really, really hurts, or when I'm really, really happy. Because when it really, really hurts, I need to remember where I came from, or I'm reminded of where I came from and how I need to get back to where I want to be. And when I'm doing really, really well, for me personally, it's just like, had this happen to me, holy crap, God, you know? And I'm scared at that point, too, because I don't want to relapse because things are too good. You know, I don't want to think I'm ever going to get better, you know? For a long time, I deceived myself thinking that, oh, I was young, you know, I'm not, you know, it was a college thing, you know, maybe, can it be, you know, because I didn't really want to be a recovering alcoholic, you know, I wanted to be normal, whatever normal was, and thankfully I'm not, you know, thankfully I'm like everybody else, but I have a place to come to talk to a friend, have a way to communicate to my higher power. I have a system that, you know, very clearly, step by step, takes an idiot like me and walks me through it. I will say this, that my victim's family and I have a good relationship today. Haven't always, but we do today, and that is a huge blessing. Since I've gotten out, I'm trying to check my time here. Since I've gotten out, I do have a job today, which is great. I have a car, which I can't believe it. I have a driver's license. I'm not a very good driver. And then I got married. I've sponsored women. I've listened to a bunch of Fifth Steps. And I go to meetings, you know. And I, aside from those things, I don't really know, like I said, I'm not a shining example of this program, and I don't know what else I put into it to get a good result, but I feel like I have a good result, you know. I have a sobriety today that I want to keep, and I ache to keep. And it's funny because, like last week or 2 weeks ago, we were following this band around for a little while, and they were, they're like a hippie jam band kind of group, and so they follow a lot of the same Grateful Dead arenas, And it's funny because, like, everybody's there just wasted, you know. Everybody's wasted. It's fun. I mean, I'm not going to lie. And I used to be one of those people, and I had a good time. But I can't do that today. And so I'm around all these, like, pot smokers and all this alcohol. And I'm just like, damn, you know. And it's not even tempting. It's just, like, it makes me really uncomfortable. But they have, like, people. They have what they call fellowship. It's the Fish Fellowship. The band's name is Fish. And they have what's called fellowship. And so halfway through the concert, they have set break. And then the set break, everybody goes, and they meet at this one tent with all these yellow balloons, and we have a meeting. It's the coolest thing. I mean, it was amazing. So for four nights, while I was sitting there watching all these different shows, I could go and have a meeting and be around all these really grateful people who are just happy that they could be a part of something good. You know, and when I first came in, I didn't want to be here because I didn't want to give up my life. I felt like I was training in something like this awesome existence of being, you know, these leftovers of a human being, you know, and just this pile of crap that I felt, and this moody, depressive, you know, just mess of a girl that I used to be. I didn't want to trade all that in because I didn't know what I was going to get back. You know, it could somehow be worse because I don't know. But it's not. It's a lot better. And I wouldn't say if it wasn't a lot better. So for any of the newer people who are out there, just wait. I mean, those promises, man, gosh, they're so good. I mean, when you get them, you just don't want to let this thing go because you're so afraid of losing all that that peace, you know, that like, today I feel like I fit in my own skin and I don't even have to have a drug or a drink to get there, you know? I mean, I want to break out of my skin some days because it's just like, I know that, I don't even know how to describe it. I'm kind of at a loss for words for that, because it's just, it's such a wonderful feeling to feel like you're in the presence of something really good. And like right here, I feel like I'm in the presence of a lot of really good people. And it just charges you up or something. But again, not a perfect sober person. There's plenty of days where I'm cussing, spitting. I mean, I made an illegal left-hand turn on the way over here. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, some perfect, you know, driver or citizen or whatever. But I try, you know, I mean, I'm trying to be a better person. And I do that because I get those moments of that serenity, those moments of my higher power in my life that just make it so much easier. And this year in particular has been a crappy year. Crappy, crappy, crappy year. Dad was diagnosed with breast cancer. Prostate cancer. And boots are fine. But Dad was diagnosed with cancer, and that was a big blow. My dog died in January, which was absolutely agony for me, because I had her for 15 years, and she saw everything from start to finish, and it was hard to lose her. I about got a divorce, about, you know, just fell apart, you know, in a lot of ways. It was a rough year. And things are looking better now, but it's because I did a force to step on it. Imagine that, you know, and found out what my part was and how I'm just, you know, doing my same old pattern of behavior, you know, trying to take control, trying to run people and run the show, and I'm so bad at that. You think I would get it through that I'm not very good at this, so I should really stop, but I'm not fixed, you know, I mean, it's just, and that's one thing I know is that I'm never going to be fixed, you know. I hope that when I die, they can finally call me recovered, you know, that they'll chip it on my old tombstone, recovered, with a B, not in recovery or recovering, you know, I'm recovered, so that's my dream or whatever, but. I would encourage anybody here who's new, meet people. There's a lot of really good people out there. Get a sponsor. If there's anything else that I would recommend in this whole process, and this whole thing, if you don't know if you belong, you don't know if you want to be here, whatever, get a sponsor and just try it, you know. Man, it was so helpful to bounce things off of her, because I'd have these fantastic ideas, and then I'd tell her about it, and she's like, that's not a fantastic idea, actually. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This is crap, and this isn't a good idea, you know, and at that point, I'm still a free woman, I can still do whatever the heck I want to do. I didn't always follow her advice, but typically, she was right, you know, and it's a good sounding board. And she would call me on my bullshit. She would tell me when I wasn't going to enough meetings. She would say, you know, we need to do a fourth and fifth step on this. She says, you're being too this, that, or the other in these cases. Or, sounds like you're doing pretty good. And it was like, wow, you get to those days, you're like, oh, okay, I guess I do feel pretty good. So, you know, so get a sponsor if you're new to the program or you're just trying to figure it out. They're free, like they always say at the end of the meetings. But they do a world of good. Aside from that, that's all there is to say about me. I appreciate your time, and I know I'm a little early, but that's all I got. Thank you.
That was amazing. Thank you very much. Very powerful. The seventh tradition, every group ought to be self-supporting, and we try to be, but your donations support this group in AA at Zone, so we do appreciate your generosity. And Jay is going to help me with the chips.
I'm Jay. I'm an alcoholic. You've got to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Join our way of life. The first chip you get is a white one. Anybody want to pick up a white chip tonight? Join us. The next one's pretty. It's silver and shiny. 30 days. Anybody got 30 days? How about red? It's Georgia Bulldog colors for 90 days. Huh? 6 months, full yellow. Anybody got 6 months? I know I'm dirty. You don't have to hug me. 9 months, green. Anybody got a birthday tonight? The coveted blue chip. All right. Congratulations on the
good job, Jay. Okay, time for announcements. What do we got? Anybody? Like to make? Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
I have a chip. I have a key to the lift. You don't want to like it, you have to be.
And they can also get a chip while they're back there, too. If you want a special memento chip, a commemorative chip. Anybody else? So everybody survived the roundup? Hey, Frank.
Frank, is it dance?
Yes.
I don't know when it is, but it's out there somewhere.
Somebody knows. This Saturday? Okay, so they have an 8 o'clock meeting in the back, a 12 and 12 meeting this Saturday. And that breaks up at 9. Then they're going to get the room ready at 9:30. The music starts. So Nava throws great dances. Don't bring your own. Okay, so next week we've got M.P. He's a member of the Heavy Hitters group. And he is going to be here. I had him previously scheduled. He did have a family issue that I'm sure he'll share that information with us. But he will be here next Monday night. Okay, so any other? Yes? You got it? Oh, nope. Okay. You sure? Okay, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
I'll never forget you saying it too. I didn't feel that.